Hello and welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals Perspectives Forum Live, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional and complementary medicine. So welcome everybody. Now before I begin this evening, I want to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today and wherever they are listening, wherever you are listening from. So thank you. So I'm Adrian Lopresti. I have the pleasure of being the host of today for these great ambassadors that we're going to talk everything healthy brain. And so we'll talk about the healthy brain and how to achieve that. And I can see that many of you are already consuming your resveratrol, which is brilliant. So you're already looking for the healthy brain perspectives. So, and as usual, we're joined by my fellow FX Medicine ambassadors. So we've got Lisa Kosabia, Mick Alexander, how are you going?
Hello.
And Emma Sutherland.
Hi, Adrian. Thanks for having us.
So we hope today that at the end of today that you will go away with something that you can utilise and implement in practice on Monday. So hopefully, as we're going through things this evening, just basically think about something that you can utilise, something that you can take away with you. If you're in practice, take away with you and work with your clients to help them achieve a healthy brain. So what are the key elements of an optimal, healthy brain? Now, obviously, there's no simple solution to that, but before we do that, I'm going to get you to do an exercise and see how good your brain is. So who's been at the workshop all today? Few of you. So your brain will be working optimally, and with the resveratrol, it will be working even better. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a word recall task. Okay, so what's going to happen is there's going to be 10 words that are going to appear on the screen. They're going to appear for 1 second each, and they're going to disappear. I want you to try to remember all those 10 words, and then we're going to get each of you up here, and then I'll get you to write it down on a piece of paper and see how many words you can remember. Then get rid of the piece of paper and we'll revisit it later. You ready? No? Okay, get your piece of paper and your pen. Okay. Everybody ready? Well, I'm going to start anyway. Ready? Go. Great, now write it down. So we've got them all. You were able to remember them all.
Yeah. I'm on top of it.
Locked in.
Yeah, it's all locked in for us.
On top of it. Yeah.
Terrific.
No pen.
There were 10 words. Okay, when you're done, you can compare it with your person sitting next to you if you want to, see who's more cognitively all there. I'm shocking at this task. So then get rid of that piece of paper. I'm going to revisit it later on. So now we're going to use a bit more larger, longer words, more difficult words to describe just what is the hallmarks of brain aging. And this is a paper that was published in 2023 looking at what are the hallmarks of brain aging, what's going on. And what we know is that when it comes to brain aging, it's not just about the build-up of amyloid plaques. It's far more complex than that. And there's a whole range of physiological factors that are going on that impact on brain health. And as a result of that, that's why we know that there's no simple solution. There's never going to be a drug that's going to treat all of these imbalances and all these disturbances that are going on from a physiological perspective. And so what we know is that there's pathological protein aggregation going on. There's research indicating there that then impacts on cell communication. So there's research showing that there's synaptic and neuronal network defects that are going on from a brain perspective. That impacts on cell-to-cell communication. We know the synapse is important for cell-to-cell communication. And there's research indicating that that's the case. There's aberrant proteostasis going on. That is also happening. The cytoskeletal abnormalities. So if you... I'm not going to go through all of this, but if you want to read the paper, certainly download it. And I talked about sleep earlier today, one that will definitely help you fall asleep this evening if you want to have a read of that before. But we've also got mitochondria and energy production, ATP production. We've got DNA and RNA defects. We know inflammation, everything inflammation these days, but certainly there's more and more research indicating that inflammation is playing a big role in the health of our brain. And then ultimately, over time, what eventually happens is there's neuronal cell death that occurs. So that's where, again, as I just want to highlight, there's no magic pill. And obviously, there's a whole range of factors that we know are going to impact on brain health and lead to this pathophysiology. And so what are those things? You know, what's going on that's impacting on the brain? Now, I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but ultimately what we do know is there's a whole range of factors that are going on that influence brain health. And we know that there's an increasing body of research showing that our diet plays a big role in our health. And we know that our diet will impact on many of those pathophysiologies that I just talked about earlier. We've got physical activity, again, strong body of evidence there. Sleep and social connections, even social connections. You know, people think about social connections being important from obviously a social point of view, but there's even research showing that good social connections, healthy social connections, can have an anti-inflammatory effect. So there's even that research indicating that that's a case. So we need to think about that. When we're working with our clients to optimise their brain health, what are their emotional coping skills like? How do they deal with stress? What strategies are they utilising there? I won't go through all of it. So there's a nutritional status. Obviously, there's environment and nature that plays a role. There's increasing research about toxin exposure and smoking and alcohol use. We know that medications can play a role. So ultimately, when we're working with our clients, it's about thinking about these particular areas and what areas do we need to target and particularly implement. And it might be very different for one person as opposed to another. Dietary intervention may be extremely effective for a client who comes in who's eating a poor diet. But a person who's already eating a really, really good diet, if we improve their diet by 5%, we're not going to really get that much impact. But if we have somebody whose diet is good but their sleep is poor, that's where our target of intervention needs to occur. It's about improving their sleep. And if we can improve their sleep by 30 minutes, then that's going to have a dramatic effect overall as a holistic intervention. Is there anything you guys want to add to any of that or...?
No, not really.
Okay.
You're doing a pretty good job yourself, to be honest.
All right. So it's working really well. All right. Now, what is a healthy brain? I mean, that's the other thing too, is what is a healthy brain? And so, you know, often people think a healthy brain is having good memory and good attention, and that's part of it. You know, good cognitive function is part of it. Having good short-term memory, having good episodic memory, having good executive function, being able to plan and set goals and revise goals and things like that are really important. But it's not just about cognitive function. You can't just necessarily just do a cognitive test and go, yep, your brain is healthy. That's only one part of a healthy brain. And you know, there's a whole range of different cognitive tests that we can do. You can't even really do... I mean, ultimately, you could do, you know, MRIs and PET scans and things like that to look at what a healthy brain is. But that doesn't necessarily always translate into what's actually happening behaviourally and cognitively and from a motor perspective. So a good, healthy brain is having good cognitive function. It's good motor function. So what's my client who's coming in today, we're working on a healthy brain, what's their motor function like? How's that kind of impacting? And what are some things we can do to help improve motor function? And certainly Lisa will talk a bit about that. We've got mood and emotional regulation. That's part of a healthy brain too. So how do they manage their emotions? What are their emotions like? How reactive do they become to stresses? And how do they manage those stresses is another thing that we need to kind of consider when we're working with them. What's their sensory function like? So obviously you've got your sight and your five senses. Eyes, ears.
Smell.
Taste.
Touch.
Yes, you have all those different senses that we have available to us. And you also have, obviously, you know, your sense of heat and all those different things that also occur. So what's their sensory function like? And also what's their social function like? So for me, a healthy brain is, this is the components of a healthy brain. Let's not just concentrate on cognitive function, what their memory and attention is like, but also think about all those other aspects. And that's my opinion, a healthy components of a healthy brain. Now, I'm going to hand over to Lisa. Now, can you tell us what some of your view of what a healthy brain and some components of how to target a healthy brain?
Absolutely. So for me, a healthy brain is a plastic brain, which I know, I was talking to my daughter about this. She's like, a plastic brain? What? But we know plasticity is where the brain is able to be adaptable, to change, and that's down to the health of our neurons. So for me, I'm in line with you in thinking a healthy brain is one that integrates our senses, so our sight, our smell. It helps us control our behaviour, our movement, and of course it is very important for cognitive function. If we think about the neurons, I was blown away to learn that we have, you've maybe got more, 100 billion neurons, all of us. Sometimes it feels like I've only got about 3 functioning, but we all have 100 billion communicating with each other at the same time. And they communicate at such a fast speed, apparently as fast as the Formula One cars are going around the Grand Prix. So that's pretty crazy to think today that all of us sitting here have got 100 billion neurons communicating at the same time, right?
Yeah. Look, the person who counted those 100 billion, I just said, no, just astounding. How long would that have taken?
How did they do
that? Yeah, it's like, I'll start again. Right. No, that's great. So in terms of those neurons and kind of maintaining our health of our brain, what things do you recommend?
So I'm in line with you as a naturopath, diet is obviously crucial for healthy brain function. We know there's a few different diets that have been studied for optimal brain health, the MIND diet, Mediterranean diet, the flexible ketogenic diet. Obviously, they have their similarities and differences, but in terms of the things that bring them together, we know they're whole food diets. We know they contain lots of essential fatty acids. We know the brain is 60% fat, so obviously those healthy fats are very important. Now, when we consume those healthy fats, we get an increase in brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which you know is a protein responsible for helping with our memory consolidation. So healthy fats we see across all those diets. We also see lots of fruits and vegetables, herbs and spices, and with those, they bring with them anti-inflammatory and antioxidant constituents. And we know, if you've been here today, that we're exposed to a lot of neuroinflammation, and obviously those fruits and vegetables help to offset that. What else can I say? Within those diets, hydration is obviously important. The brain is comprised of water, so that's a crucial thing that I would think that would help with brain function. I know when I'm dehydrated, I definitely feel a little bit cognitively impaired. You talked a little bit about stress, I think, in one of your slides. For me, I was blown away to understand that when people have early childhood trauma, the hippocampus actually shrinks. It's smaller than individuals who haven't experienced stress. So I think asking about stress with our patients is important, and then implementing some stress adaptation protocols. Sleep, I know you talked about sleep this morning. For me, sleep's a big one because a lot of people struggle with that. Obviously, when we sleep, our glymphatic system is working to remove toxins and the build-up of those plaques. So there's a couple of things that I think are important.
Terrific. Now, I know that certainly physical activity and there's increasing body research of physical activity to prevent cognitive decline and also to maintain the health of our brain. And I know that you had a podcast with Dr. Helena Popovich and on adventure, and can you tell us a little bit about that and what you covered?
Yeah, I loved having Helena on the podcast, and I chose to showcase this one with you because she just brought with her so much energy and so many practical suggestions, which I personally found really, really helpful. So the adventure part of her She's written a book called Adventure Prevents Dementia, and the adventure part really resonated with me because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm seeing clients in clinic, I find that the adventure part is usually missing from their lives, and I think it's a very important part for us to add into the prescription. So when we think about adventure, adventure is usually associated with novelty, and novelty brings with it the unknown, a little bit of excitement sometimes because it's new. Sometimes it's a little bit scary because we have to move out of our comfort zone. What does this have to do with cognitive health? Well, the research shows that when we are exposed to novelty, so these new things, we actually light up parts of our brain, like the hippocampus and the cortex. They actually increase the dopamine activity in those parts of the brain. And that dopamine activity is associated with memory acquisition and learning. So for me, the adventure part is incredibly important for improving our cognitive health. And a lot of patients, you know, they're into the supplements, they're into the herbs, but they don't realise just how important the novelty is in daily life. Now, there is a caveat in this. The adventure and the novelty seems to work best for people that have healthy brains, so everyone in this room. Once you have more advanced dementia, the novelty doesn't seem to work in the same way. So as much as is possible now, we're trying to get as much novelty in. Now, when I'm talking about novelty, it doesn't have to be anything wild. Don't know what you're thinking about in terms of novelty, but we're thinking learning a new language, doing a new hobby like pottery, maybe doing a different type of exercise, travelling somewhere different. It can be as mild as that.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think you make a good point because you certainly, you know, the adventure early on, and then obviously once people have developed that delay, then it can sometimes be quite overwhelming for them. Yeah. So it's really important there. No, great. So. And I suppose adventure, so you mentioned kind of adventure is very individualised, so it's depending on their personality and, yeah, terrific. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily about jumping out of a plane or things like that.
You could do that, but it doesn't have to be bungee jumping or skydiving or anything ultra exciting. Yeah, it can just be something different. Jumping out of the comfort zone, yeah. And in terms of the exercise that you mentioned, I picked this picture and it really doesn't do Helena's biceps justice, but if you ever see her, you'll know what I mean. We were all transfixed by her arm muscles. They are super toned, and the reason they are that way is that she is actually GP. And her father was diagnosed with dementia. And it inspired this journey into understanding more and this concept of adventure to mitigate dementia. And one thing she was really passionate about and spoke a lot of on the podcast is the importance of grip strength and strength training. And when you look at the research on grip strength, there's a UK Biobank study undertaken in 2022 using a very large UK cohort. The research is basically showing a correlation between grip strength and cognitive health and dementia. So in that study, individuals with the weakest grip strength had a much higher incidence of cognitive decline compared to those with the strongest grip strength. So there was actually a 72% increase incidence in cognitive decline with that weaker grip strength. So if you're like me and you're always looking for someone else to open the pickles jar or jam jar, you might be on high alert for risk of cognitive decline, right? Now, for me, it's exciting to read these studies on grip strength because we don't have a test for dementia. Usually we're seeing patients apply a reactive rather than a proactive approach to, you know, implementing strategies. But if we can test grip strength in clinic, which after this evening, I think you're all going to be going out and buying the machine to do it because it's super easy, we can basically mitigate that risk. Okay, it's easy-ish to do, I think, right? I know you use the machine, I know M does as well. So within the systematic reviews, they're actually showing that we can use grip strength as a possible predictor to identify cognitive decline early and intervene.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, certainly measuring it and having a tool to be able to measure it's great. I mean, obviously, you know, people who open jars, you know, obviously it depends on how sometimes it really is at a...
Is it a
unscrew
jar?
And it, or, yeah. So grip strength's great. Are you going to show us?
I am. I'm
how
looking
to use it?
For a volunteer / victim who wants to come to the front. Yay!
All right.
All right. M's gonna be my assistant. Okay. So this is the dynamometer. So she's just going to clench and grip as hard as she can for 5 seconds.
Zero out. So, yep. And 3, 2, 1, go. And hold it for 3, 2.
Your feet have to be on the floor as well.
Feet on the floor. Stop. Yep.
Okay.
No other muscles moving.
Superstar. 62.2.
So that's in pounds.
Yep.
Or kilos.
No, that's pounds.
Pounds. Do you want to do it again in kilos?
That was really good.
Well, who knows if it's 62 pounds.
It's 2.2. kilograms to a pound or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if we were doing it in kilograms, I know the kilogram scales, we have a different scale for males and females, but basically in kilograms, for women,
yeah,
optimal is 30. Over 30, and for men you're looking at about 60 and higher.
So yep. About
okay.
I did about 100, I think, before.
Which is you did 100?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I was average, and Emma, unsurprisingly, was
well done.
Above
thanks
average.
For that.
Yeah. So it's easy, right? Like, how exciting is that to be able to purchase something like that, do it for all your patients in clinic? It's just a beautiful preventative intervention. And we start losing muscle in our 30s. We know most people with dementia are diagnosed in their 70s. But it starts much earlier. So if we can intervene earlier, it's just such a great tool.
So what's going on? I mean, why the relationship between grip strength and cognitive health?
Okay, yeah, it's really, you wouldn't think they kind of go together, but we're now learning that there is this mind-muscle connection, which doesn't surprise us as holistic practitioners because we know the systems don't work in isolation. So essentially we've got brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which I think you guys are all familiar with. We find brain-derived neurotrophic factor in the muscles, but we know in the brain it works with increasing memory consolidation and acquisition. It also keeps our neurons incredibly healthy. So those people with the weakest hand grip strength also had very low BDNF. And when you train the muscle and you increase muscle strength, BDNF increases, which leads to better memory. So this mind-muscle connection, super interesting. There's also a relationship, they think, between vitamin D and muscle strength. So we have vitamin D receptors all over our central nervous system. And when vitamin D is low, our hand grip strength is low too. As soon as you replete vitamin D in people that are deficient, their hand grip strength increases and we can basically hypothesise that cognitive function would improve too.
Terrific. Thanks for that.
I was going to say, I actually saw a study that looked at grip strength and walking speed. So it was a 2022 randomised controlled trial, and it was basically aimed at people in their 70s, they were about 75, and what they did is they walked 3 metres, and they did it twice and did an average of that speed, and they found that those people that declined in their walking speed, there was a 49% correlation with dementia, and there was a 45% correlation with cognitive decline. And that trial was done over around about 5 years. So they use very similar neurological pathways. So either grip speed and or gait speed can be used in that.
Terrific. Thanks for that, Mick. Now, Lisa, have you got any other suggestions for us?
Well, in your bags, I've got a little surprise for you. You've all got a stress ball in there with the brain. So if you're looking to, if you're looking to improve your grip strength, you can use a stress ball, not just for stress, but actually to increase your hand grip strength. So there's actually research on the stress ball. So you can all just sit here today and do that and know that your hippocampus volume is probably increasing. if you want to take it up a notch, yes, that's actually what my partner was saying, where he's doing that same movement when we were practicing this speech. But we also have the hand grips that you can use. These are on my deadlifts, my weights. So they're about $7 from Rebel. This is a little bit more resistant, so it's a little bit harder while you're watching TV. Just a little bit of this every night, and you're going to be increasing the volume of your brain, different parts of your brain involved with learning. And, of course, make sure your vitamin D is optimal too.
Terrific. All right. And if people drinking wine, just grip it really strong. And you're getting the resveratrol and the hand grip strength going at the same time. So, terrific. Oh, you can see that I'm jealous. Okay. Have you got anything else for us, Lisa?
Well, I do.
Yeah. What other tips have you got for us?
Okay. So continuing on with the muscle strength theme, Helena also talks on her website about tongue strength. So we know the tongue is a muscle. It's actually 8 muscles intertwined. And now when you look at the research, they're noticing a correlation between tongue volume and brain volume, particularly of the hippocampus. So the weaker the tongue, basically the smaller the hippocampus. But don't despair. You can train your tongue to become more muscular, and this is what I'm going to take you through right now. So remember, we're doing a novel act together now, which is also going to contribute to your brain health. So we're going to start off with some tongue push-ups. Okay, so I want you to push your tongue up against the roof of your mouth as hard as you can for 5 seconds. Okay, 1, 2, are you doing this, Adrian? 3, 4, 5. Okay, excellent. And then push down against the bottom of your mouth, the floor of your mouth, for 5 seconds. Hard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then tongue extension. So everyone, stick out your tongue. 1, like the lady in the picture. 2, very nicely. 3, 4, 5, very good. And tongue in cheek to the left. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then to the other side. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Excellent. And then the last one, I want you to try and stretch your tongue to touch your nose. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Very good. Now, if you're a woman, I'll give you a little tip. Your tongue is shorter, so it's much harder for you to touch your nose compared to men. Men have longer tongues.
I didn't know that. Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting tidbit. Okay, terrific. Now, any other comments? I know that certainly Helena talked about purpose and meaning, and that's really important from a cognitive perspective. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So sense of purpose and also connection also really resonate with me because, again, I don't know about you guys in your clinic, but connection is so important, and even though we are living in a world where we've got so much connection with social media and things like that, so many people still do feel disconnected. So I loved this quote from her: people are more powerful than pills, and our relationships with each other are the most important things keeping us healthy. Because within the literature, again, you'll see meta-analysis, systematic reviews showing us that connection and sense of purpose are incredibly protective towards the brain. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. Grandparents who look after their grandchildren for between 1 and 39 hours a week, that's a lot, yep, actually have less dementia than those that don't look after their grandchildren at all. You're laughing, and this is also quite interesting. if the grandparent gets custody of the child and does more than 39 hours, then there is no protection from dementia. Super interesting, because obviously kids can be quite stressful. Okay. So, yeah, it's because they get to give them back that it's protective. There's also a great little study undertaken on women who were in their 50s, they were showing signs of mild cognitive impairment, and they were part of a study where they had to volunteer with children, helping them with their literacy, so reading and writing. And they did a before MRI and an after MRI. And after the volunteering intervention, the women's brain centres that were involved with memory were working better, they were more activated, and they did better on all the memory tests, similar to the one that Adrian got us to do in the beginning. They performed better. So volunteering, that sense of purpose, that connection, actually improved brain function, which is great.
Great. So thank you very much for that. I know we're running out of time. Is there anything else you want to add?
I'll just very quickly talk about this woman here, Patty. So Helena wanted everyone to put her into YouTube. Go listen to the episode because it's great. And she talks about this lady here who is 77 when her partner passed away. And Patty Jones, her name is. And she decided to take up dancing, tango and acrobatic dancing at 77 because she didn't want her life to be meaningless. So for me, she is the epitome of what we can all do in terms of purpose, connection, movement. There are actually PubMed studies on tango as an intervention for reducing dementia. They compared tango to just general exercise. The patients that did tango had improved gait and better memory than those that just did the regular exercise. Super exciting. Mm. So exercise doesn't have to be the traditional slogging it away on the treadmill or anything like that. It can be just something, I wouldn't say simple, but something as fun and as exciting as this.
Brilliant. So we can all take up tango. Some of us anyway. Okay, so terrific. So thank you very much for that. Yeah, sure. So that was brilliant. So obviously we've got some, yes. Well done. So we're all going to be testing our grip strength, and we're going to be doing tongue exercises. Try not to do it in public because you look pretty silly. Certainly there's, and obviously a sense of purpose and meaning are the really key takeaways for me. So great. Now I've got a few questions. Let's have a look here. So an anonymous, now put your name to it so we can, when you're doing it, so sending a question. You mentioned that the hippocampus shrinks with childhood trauma. Do we know if we're able to expand it with certain treatments or therapy or lifestyle changes, or does it stay shrunk for life?
I think the brain is plastic, and I think with all these different interventions and connection, I'm pretty sure we can see changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a susceptibility. So what's going to happen is that the research shows that when there's childhood trauma, and even as early as in utero, it can be long-standing, the effects. But certainly you're right. There's certainly plasticity there, and obviously the earlier intervention, the greater efficacy we're going to get. But I mean, I think that the research consistently does show that if you have trauma, you're at greater susceptibility. But then if you also have genes for obesity, I suppose, then you're also going to grow, but you still need to engage in things to kind of compensate for that. So if you have a family history of depression, it's always going to be there, but it's engaging in behaviours to kind of mitigate against that. So it's so brilliant. Can you improve your cognitive outlook by improving grip strength?
Yes.
Yeah, I think if you hold the thing and say, like, I'm a good person, I'm a great person, and I mean, I suspect, look, BDNF is also linked with mental health, yeah, with depression. So if you're doing something that's going to increase neurotrophic factors such as BDNF, you're probably going to see positive effects in mood too. So yeah, absolutely. Last question. Is the same correlation seen in children and younger cohorts between grip strength and cognition?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen any studies undertaken in children.
Yeah, we got some really intelligent questions here. It's just beyond our pay grade, but, I suspect there probably hasn't been, but that's a very interesting question. You know, does grip strength correlate with, what are kids with ADHD and grip strength? That would be something interesting to do for sure. So, so terrific. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. Mick?
Yes. Let me take the clicker.
Can you tell us a little bit about where things that we can do to improve our brain function and things that adversely affect it?
Well, says the man who couldn't remember the five senses half an hour ago.
Yeah. I still can't remember them.
You've asked us to remember 10 words on a screen, so anyway. In terms of, a lot of pharmaceutical medicines can have an effect on our brain health. Generally in the areas of mitochondrial dysfunction, glial cell activation and neuroinflammation, as well as oxidative stress. And in fact, there are some medications that can increase our cortisol levels, and that can play havoc with our lymphatic system and have an effect on our waste reduction, or getting rid of waste in the brain. So, pharmaceutical drugs will definitely have an effect on the body, and particularly in the areas and the most common medications that we use now tend to affect it in areas where they cause dysbiosis. They will also cause a reduction in key nutrients such as vitamin B12. They'll also have a secondary effect in that they can increase nutrients through the reduction of B12 such as homocysteine. So these are reductions or alterations in these biochemicals can have long-term effects on brain health.
I know, Mick, you're going to be doing a talk on the gut-brain connection, and so I encourage people to sign up for that. It's going to be brilliant. So, Now, in terms of the relationship between pharmaceuticals and the gut, I mean, what's going on there? What's the research indicate there?
The research indicates that there are quite a lot of medications that have this effect. Particularly if we look at, the top 10 prescribed medications, they have this effect on the composition of the gut microbiota, and that in turn has an effect on the intercommunication between the gut and the brain and the higher levels of the brain. So that's in the basic level what's going on there.
Now, there's not many of us on pharmaceutical medications, are there?
Oh, yes, there is. So if I can just... So I don't know if anyone knows of a band called Weezer. They were pretty big in the 90s, had a few big songs out there. They've got a song called We Are All On Drugs from the early 2000s. And it's funny, whenever I hear this song, it always reminds me of the fact that, most of us will either have taken something, be on something, or we'll end up on something at some stage in our lives.
So, Mick, when would you hear this song?
When?
Yeah.
You would have heard it in 2005.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. From an album, Make Believe. It's all right, I'm a big fan. I just,
Has got anybody heard of this song? Oh, a couple. Okay.
There you go. There are some people that have some decent musical taste in Australia. Adrian, they're not all like you.
Justin Bieber is great.
Sorry, what was that?
Justin Bieber's great.
Okay. So look, really, there are some surveys that tell us that, and these are surveys from naturopaths that tell us that a lot of their patients will also be under a doctor at the same time. A survey that was done with a large cohort of naturopaths, so we're talking about 56 naturopathic clinics over 14 different countries, told us that around about 50% of their patients, or actually 43% to be precise, were under the care of a GP at the same time. And when they delved into that survey a little further, around about 30% of their patients would have been under a specialist. So it's, you can assume that most of the patients, or a large proportion of patients that these naturopaths had answered this questionnaire had, were at least getting treated by a general practitioner or someone like that, and more than likely would have had some medication. Now, a more recent study in 2023 amongst consumers found that those that answered the survey, and it was a large survey, around about 2,350 people answered it, 50% of those admitted to using complementary medicines with either prescribed or over-the-counter medication. And of those people that actually admitted to it, 50% of those took their complementary medicines either on the same day or at the same time with their standardised or their conventional meds at the same time. So definitely there is a lot of people that are taking a lot of medicines and they're taking them at the same time as complementary medicines.
And what are the most commonly used medications?
Yeah, so if we, so what I've done is I've had a look at the, and I should really say before I jump into that, the sorts of things that these naturopaths were treating were conditions really that lend itself to the gut-brain axis, things such as gastrointestinal conditions. A lot of these were functional ones, and we know that people that have IBS and conditions like that, almost 90% of those have mental health or mood disorders. And there were mental health, a lot of patients were seeking out naturopathic help for mental health conditions, and we know that people with mental health conditions, almost 50% of those also have gastrointestinal complaints. So there's definitely a gut-brain axis effect there. And look, I've often said to people that when, if I've, you know, in pharmacy, because I do most of my work in pharmacy these days, when people come in and they start on, say, SSRIs, I'll often say to them, hey, you know, you really should consider using a probiotic with this or at the start or during the treatment. And when they say, well, how does that work? I always say, well, do you know Pavlov's dog? And of course, Pavlov's dog is, you know, at the most basic level is a gut-brain axis interaction. But of course, he didn't have one dog, he had many dogs. And I don't know what's going on with that dog in the harness there on the picture, but unfortunately, I wouldn't like to think what happened to these poor dogs afterwards. But that's, you know, in its, you know, in a, at a very basic level, that's what we're talking about. So what are we on? So what I did is I looked at the top 10 medications that were listed on the PBS. So these are by prescription count between 2023 and 24, and broke those down into a list of six groups there. Some of them crossed over. There were a couple of statins, a couple of antibiotics, a couple of PPIs. And so when we broke it down, in that group of six, at least five of those different groups have an effect on brain health or brain ageing. So
I know that statins obviously impact on CoQ10 and mitochondrial function, but do they also impact on gut health?
Yeah, so there are some statins, and some of these are very common statins, things like atorvastatin and pravastatin, have been shown in mice studies to have an effect on bacterial cancer, in particular Firmicutes bacteria. They can reduce those. Now, the reason why that's important is Firmicutes are high butyrate producers, and we know butyrate's got a role in leaky gut as well as blood-brain barrier. The other thing that some statins can do, and these are certainly some of the lipophilic statins, things such as simvastatin, atorvastatin, and lovastatin, they can also have an effect on cognitive decline. But these effects, thankfully, have been reversible in the studies I've looked at. But particularly people that are taking higher doses. So we're looking at people post heart attack that are on super high doses of statins. There is a chance that they can have some kind of reversible cognitive decline when they're on it as well. And the other thing with some of the more common statins, they can reduce or change the level of bile acids that are produced in the gut. And what that does is it produces more bile acid-tolerant bacteria there. And the result of that is that we start to see increases in fasting glucose levels, and then we start to see weight gain, and we start to see some effects with or greater risks of developing type 2 diabetes. And a lot of people that take statins, they do run into an issue where they are more prone to type 2 diabetes.
Thanks for that. I mean, what about, obviously there you've got PPIs, so we can understand that PPIs impacting on the gut. I mean, how profound are the effects of PPIs on gut?
Yeah, so there was a fairly big study that came out of the Netherlands, so with a little over 1,800 people, and they found that the change in the microbiota in the gut was as high as 20% in that population. And they actually looked at three groups. They looked at healthy people, they looked at people with IBS, and people with inflammatory bowel disease, and they found around in each group, there was that change of around about 20%, where you had bacteria coming from the oral cavity invading down into the deeper recesses of the bowel. So there were those sorts of changes. And of course, PPIs, we know they reduce magnesium. And I saw a small case study with only four people, but it was quite a long case study where they followed these people over a period of about 5 to 7 years, and they looked at very common PPIs, things like esomeprazole and pantoprazole. In fact, on the top 10 drugs, esomeprazole and pantoprazole are the two most prescribed PPIs on the PBS. In that study, they found that they caused hypomagnesia or clinical hypomagnesia in those patients. And when we get low levels of magnesium, we start to see an increase in NMDA receptor activity, and we start to see microglial cell activation. We start to see increases in neuroinflammation and oxidative stress from NAC. And there are actually a couple of PPIs that can cross the blood-brain barrier. These are pretty common ones like lansoprazole and omeprazole. Omeprazole is very highly used. And some of those PPIs can actually change the pH of brain cells. And what this does is this increases the level of amyloid beta 42 that's produced in brain cells, because this is one of the end products of amyloid precursor protein when it's broken down. And amyloid beta 42 certainly long-term is implicated in Alzheimer's disease, but even in the early stages is involved in oxidative stress and neuroinflammation. So there are a lot of these effects from statins that we're unaware of, from PPIs, I should say, that we're unaware of.
I mean, it's concerning because obviously PPIs were originally used short-term, but people are using them, you know, for years on end. I know my father-in-law, for example, is on it for 20 years.
Well, I've not seen too many people that start on PPIs come off them. So, yeah. And it's interesting, patients that come in, they'll be on a PPI, but they'll still have issues. And I'll often recommend, say, some kind of enzymes for them. And it's interesting how well they respond to using some kind of enzyme with a PPI. And then they start to work out, well, maybe the PPI is reducing my acid levels too much, and so I'm not actually digesting my food to the same level I should be.
So with PPIs, obviously you mentioned magnesium, so it's certainly be important for magnesium supplementation during that period. Is there anything else that you'd recommend for people who are on PPIs long-term or ongoingly?
Not necessarily. I wouldn't. There's nothing that comes to mind that I'd think of, unless you know something that I don't know.
I think there's been some stuff with some bees and things like that that we might be worth looking at. But certainly, I mean, obviously, you know, we've got your probiotics. We know that it's impacting on gut function.
Definitely.
So,
yeah,
so
definitely.
You've already mentioned that. So. Now, SSRIs, SSRIs is another commonly prescribed medication, and obviously from your slide there, it's demonstrating that it's significantly used. Does that affect gut function too?
Yeah, well, SSRIs, there was one study in mice where they used sertraline and fluoxetine, and they found that that caused a change in bacterial levels there. Fluoxetine in particular has been known to reduce lactobacilli. It's interesting, in the studies in mice with SSRIs, they definitely need that gut brain, the vagus nerve there. So mice that have had a vagotomy, or there's been some influence there where they've removed the vagal tone, they've found that the effects, the antidepressant effects of the SSRIs has been totally nuked, totally diminished. So that's a very important part of the way that SSRIs work, through the gut axis there. You know, there can be some dysbiosis caused by SSRIs, but antipsychotics are actually worse at that, particularly things like lithium and aripiprazole that's used quite a lot now for people in nursing homes for aggression and agitation. They use low-dose aripiprazole, as well as sodium valproate. Now, they have greater changes in the gut. They reduce things such as GABA, they have an effect on tryptophan metabolites, so we see less melatonin, less serotonin produced. So they have more significant changes. And it's interesting, when you have a look at the details or the papers on, or the information about SSRIs, it's like women can't get away from them. There was a large study in America with the Mayo Clinic Biobank, and that was a big study over 8 years, and they looked at decades in terms of, you know, women from the 20s, 30s, 40s up to 50, and men at the same time. And they found with women, they had use of SSRIs at around 28%. So when you looked at men, that was down at 14%. over the decades. But as women got older, up into their 50s, they were still on high levels, or there was a high proportion of those women still on SSRIs, whereas with men, it dropped down. And then, of course, they get to their 50s and we start to see issues with perimenopause and menopause. And what are we seeing? A really large increase in the use of now? SSRIs for vasomotor symptoms, SSRIs for anxiety and depression associated with perimenopause and menopause. It's like they just can't get away from it. And I was going to say there's another study in the States that looked at antidepressant use, so not necessarily SSRIs, and they found that women over the age of 60, 24% of them are still on antidepressants. And these were women that were university educated, from the outside looking in, looked like they had fantastic lives. They were, they had rewarding jobs. They had, functional families, a functional life. Yet still, there's really high use of antidepressants in that cohort.
I mean, it gets you thinking a little bit about obviously the impact that the SSRIs have on the gut function and whether part of the difficulty getting off them might be gut related in terms of the microbiome changes that are occurring, and maybe that's part of the withdrawal. We could potentially use that as part of the treatment to help them get off the SSRIs at some stage. Now, Emma and Lisa, you're seeing a lot of women on SSRIs postmenopausal,
an incredible amount, and it's something that I personally work really hard to educate her on other things that we could do to help offboard her when it's appropriate. But often in this life stage, it is given to manage those vasomotor problems, and then women are staying on them. So I see it as sort of my job to have the discussion around, is it still appropriate, and what other things can we kind of offboard you with?
I saw a really good study that compared SSRIs, saffron to an SSRI. So it was 30 milligrams of saffron, 15 milligrams twice a day. I don't know if it was your study or not. It may not have been your study. 15 milligrams of saffron twice a day compared to fluoxetine, 20 milligrams twice a day. Wasn't a huge study, only 66 participants. I think it was over 6 weeks. And the saffron was as effective as fluoxetine in anxiety and the depression. It was a hospital scale that they were, a hospital subjective scale that they responded to. But what was interesting was that the people that had some gut issues in that study, they responded pretty well with the use of saffron, because saffron's been known to increase bacterial diversity in the microbiome. In fact, a couple of the components of saffron, I think it's crocin, has an effect on increasing butyrate, as well as reducing pro-inflammatory cytokines, and quercetin, I think one of its other components, is really important for maintaining or enhancing that gut-brain axis or some of those pathways there. So quite that's a better choice, I think.
Yeah, I mean, certainly they've got the options of the saffron. I mean, something that probably needs to be is more efficacious with your moderate to mild severity, as opposed to the severe. I think that's where probably the antidepressants work more effectively with the severe depression, but certainly there's definite benefits there. And trying to understand how saffron works, ultimately the gut brain, the gut is one mechanism that potentially requires more investigation, so definitely. And I'm just mindful of time, Mick. So is there anything else you want to add?
Look, really, I know antibiotics, certainly they nuke the gut and they reduce the microbiome. One of the studies, I'll just mention one systematic review I saw, which had 11 randomised controlled trials, so it was quite a good study, and it indicated in particular that of those trials, if you use a multi-strain probiotic, it works more effectively than a single strain, and those multi-strain probiotics were really ones that used lactobacilli and bifidobacterium. Some of them had plus or minus Saccharomyces boulardii. But really, I think the take-home message from using probiotics in 8 weeks was the minimum use time for those probiotics. But it's really good to look at probiotics that have been tested as a total group. I know we often can choose probiotic blends where one strain's been tested, that's been shown to be proven, and then it gets combined with other strains where the evidence is either not so good. But it's really good to look for particular products or strains where each of the strains have been tested as a total group, and there are some strains like that that are available in the marketplace, and I think they're probably a better choice for us because we know those results can be reproducible if they've been shown in reasonably good trials.
How far away should the antibiotics ideally be taken away from the probiotics? You know, how long?
Usually about 2 hours. I'd always wait about 2 hours.
And 2 hours is enough?
Generally speaking, yeah. Should be enough. 4 hours is probably better.
Yep.
But then we start to run into, you know, is my brain working enough to remember that sort of thing? Interestingly, on the screen you can see clarithromycin and metronidazole. That's used in triple therapy, used quite a lot in Helicobacter. They've found from a systematic review that actually reduces your microbial or microbiome for up to 4 years after using it. 4 years. So, interestingly, how much it changes it.
Great. So, thanks, Mick. That's brilliant stuff. So, now I have no idea how you pronounce all those words. That's how I would say it. I would just pretend that the mic wasn't working.
The only thing is I went to a conference recently and they were talking about semaglutide. Does anyone know what semaglutide is?
Yeah, semi-glutide.
Yeah. Apparently we've all been pronouncing it wrong. Thank God we haven't been taking it wrong, but we may be pronouncing it wrong.
All right, so we've got any questions. Okay, it's a quick question here. How to help people safely discontinue the PPIs?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
How do we help people safely discontinue PPIs?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think it's a matter of being able to offer them choices that they can move on to and dialogue with their doctor. It's not an easy step to go through. I think I've found... In my role in pharmacy, I've found that introducing things like really good enzymes and being able to inform them about, you know, what the PPI is doing to their body and giving them... Because no one wants to be on PPIs. Whenever you speak to them, I often, when people come in and they're on something for their acid, it's like, I hate being on this, but I know if I don't take it, I'm not going to be well the next day. But then it's also about education. A lot of people that are on PPIs, sometimes they overeat, sometimes they eat the wrong food. So if they know the triggers that are causing it, if they can have a look at their portion sizes, and if they can eat more regularly and increase the level of soluble and regular fibre in their diet, sometimes I'll find that can make changes to their gut that they think, well, I might be able to take my PPI every second day or every third day. Sometimes that's even better for them than whether they may never get off. But it's really about educating the patient on what other things they can do to help their gut that helps them see that maybe their gut can work a little bit more healthily, and then it gives them the courage to maybe speak to their doctor about, say, coming off it.
Great. So, yeah, and I know sometimes people are using PPIs to compensate for bad dietary habits. So, yeah, it's great. Yeah. All right, so brilliant. So thank you very much for that, Mick. That's brilliant. So we're going to give him a round of applause, especially the way he can... And so obviously there it's the gut-brain connection, the impact that medications have on the gut, which is profound, and we're learning more and more about that. And the concerning thing is, you know, you talked about SSRIs and even antipsychotics, kids are on them now. So what impact is that having on the microbiome over time? So yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, Emma... All right.
Hello,
so
Adrian.
I know, Emma, that you have a lot of expertise in the area of hormones and their effect on overall health. And so how do changing levels of hormones in perimenopause and menopause affect women's brains?
Well, I think we could be here all day on this topic. It is such a big one and one that fascinates me endlessly. For those of you that were here earlier today, you literally had a masterclass by Dr. Sarah McKay on this topic. But we know that perimenopause, and menopause cause a roller coaster for our hormones, and this results in symptoms like anxiety, depression, insomnia, weight gain, hot flushes, night sweats, you name it. But I think what most women that come in to see us in clinic don't realise is that estrogen has such a powerful impact on our... sorry, I've been talking all day, so bear with me. Estrogen has such a powerful impact on our cognitive health and our brain function. So when you're looking at the research on estrogen and the brain, it's still in its infancy, maybe 20 years at the most. So we still have a lot to learn on the nuances involved here. But estrogen is classified as a neurohormone now, and it plays a role in oxygen levels in the brain. It plays a role in memory. It also plays a role in mood-related chemicals like serotonin and oxytocin, which decrease as estrogen drops. So there's a real reason why women at this life stage have a challenge with their mental health. So a 2024 meta-analysis showed that perimenopausal women were 1.4 times more likely to experience depressive symptoms than women that were premenopausal. And interestingly, the researchers termed perimenopause a window of vulnerability due to the declining estrogen levels. Now, as estradiol production in the ovaries decrease in menopause, this really matters when it comes to the brain. So we have estrogen receptors all throughout our brain, but we have a particular cluster in the prefrontal cortex, which is that intersection between emotion, motivation, and action. And that has a profound effect on our decision-making skills and our cognitive health.
I was going to ask, do you think they'll ever get a test for perimenopause?
I don't think that there's an accurate test because, in my view, it's a symptomatic situation. I mean, you can look at FSH levels, you know, three in a row and average them out and all of that kind of thing. But clinically, for me, I am going by signs and symptoms.
Now, obviously, the symptoms of kind of mood-related symptoms, they're quite common. Are there other, you know, in terms of cognitive changes, what happens from a cognitive standpoint during perimenopause and postmenopause?
Well, there's a lot. I'm sure all of you at some point have had a woman come in saying, I think I have early dementia. I can't find my keys. I can't find my phone. I can't even get words out sometimes. The words are stuck and they just won't come out. And I think this is a real concern for many women. I had a brilliant conversation with neuropsychologist Dr. Nicola Gates on the podcast episode, Menopause, Estrogen and the Brain, and she explained it beautifully. And she explained that we know where our car keys are, we know where the phone is, we know those words. The issue lies in the retrieval of the memory. So the enzyme that is responsible for the retrieval of the memory is estrogen dependent. And so when we have the lower levels of estrogen, that retrieval process becomes so very slow that women think they have early stage dementia. Yeah.
So does that mean that if we increase estrogen, that that's going to increase their memory capacity and their mood? Is it as simple as that?
Well, it sounds theoretically like it's possible, but as a woman, it is not that simple. I know the biology of a woman's body is so dynamic. I mean, we have so many hormones that can affect this situation. We have progesterone, which falls before estrogen, and progesterone has that beautiful calming and anxiolytic effect on our nervous system because of the way it modulates those GABA receptors. And without enough progesterone, we see women that are anxious, irritable, they can't sleep, and they feel really flat. And then we also have cortisol. So high chronic levels of cortisol can really cause haywire for our sex hormones. And this also increases systemic inflammation, which can then be a risk factor for things like depression. And then one that I see clinically a lot that I think we need to pay a bit more attention to is actually testosterone. So testosterone is such an important hormone for mood, energy, motivation, and of course libido. But this is the woman that's sitting in front of you that's saying, I'm really fatigued, I don't know what's going on. And you look at her pathology and her thyroid's fine, her iron's fine, but you also notice that she's kind of lost her mojo. She just, her energy is low, her mood is low, and don't even talk to her about sex. So there's so many hormones that, it's like a symphony orchestra of hormones in this life stage that all come together.
So you can see, obviously, though, obviously you've got estrogen and then you've got the impact of cortisol and the relationship with progesterone, and then you know, DHEA and testosterone, all those different hormones. So it's that balance, isn't it? And if you're increasing estrogen and the cortisol still remains high and inflammatory markers, is it, do you know if there's any research on what happens to cortisol postmenopausal? Have you seen anything on that? Or
I haven't seen any research, but clinically, what I want us to think about is this next slide. This paints this perfectly. So going back to that lady or the woman saying, I think I've got early dementia, what I want us to do for just 1 minute is really zoom out and look at the complete picture of what else might be going on for your perimenopausal 45-year-old patient or your menopausal 55-year-old patient. So when we look at this in totality, we see a very compelling picture. Her fluctuating estrogen is causing that slow memory retrieval and also increases her risk for depression. Her low progesterone is causing her stress response to be incredibly heightened. Her hot flushes, night sweats, or insomnia could be tanking her sleep quality and quantity. And yet she's trying to hold down a full-time job. She has elderly parents she's trying to look after. She's got teenage kids. She can't get to the gym as often as she used to because life is just busy, so her physical activity levels go down. And then we also have micronutrient deficiencies because possibly she has gut issues or maybe she's just not eating for her body. And two other factors here that were not on my radar, but I really want to share with you today. These two factors came from the SWAN study, which is the longest study we have on women in this life stage. It began in around, I think, 1998, somewhere around there, when the women were 42. And then they've collected data from these women every single year since. So there's this huge body of work here that we can lean into to get information about this life stage. And the two biggest factors the researchers found for cognitive decline in menopause was actually financial stress and borderline hypertension. So if you haven't read that study or looked at all of the data that we can get from that, I highly encourage you to.
I mean, it's amazing just looking at that, you know, all the different factors that need to be considered to help improve general health and mental and brain health and mental health. And, you know, Lisa talked earlier about obviously adventure and purpose and meaning, and that's changing at that time too. So, so all those other factors, so it's not just supplements and it's about lifestyle and psychological and social and relationships and all those other factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think about myself and I think, oof, how am I going to feel in that life stage? Am I going to wake up one day and think, God, I think I've got dementia? Because I can really understand how women feel that way, given the totality of what's going on inside their body and then in the context of the lives that they're living.
Now, is there any particular nutrient that you recommend?
Yes, I have absolute favourite here, by far, would be magnesium. So magnesium deficiency will exacerbate symptoms like anxiety, depression and insomnia. Observational data show lowest magnesium levels in women with depressive symptoms and highest magnesium levels in women without depressive symptoms, which really show that correlation between low magnesium and risk for depression. There's many reasons why a woman in this life stage will have low magnesium. Mick talked beautifully about the drug-nutrient interactions. Maybe she's on a PPI. Maybe she has malabsorption due to chronic stress or some gut dysbiosis and she's not absorbing magnesium very well. Or perhaps she has an inadequate dietary intake of magnesium and that's creating those micronutrient deficiencies. And this is all happening at the same time as she has increased requirements for magnesium. So when a woman in this life stage comes in to see you, it's very likely that she is going to have low magnesium. So the research is really clear on this beautiful nutrient. It does reduce depression. Self-reported sleep and anxiety scales improve, and magnesium 3-8 is beautiful for memory. I have a personal bias in magnesium. I dose quite hefty. I usually go around 150 milligrams of magnesium citrate combined with 150 milligrams of magnesium 3-8 in the morning. And then I bookend the day with 300 milligrams of magnesium glycinate. And I see really good results with that clinically with women in this life stage.
their level's okay gut-wise? Yeah.
Well, you keep in touch with them and I titrate them up to those levels. But yes, usually if you titrate up, it's fine.
Okay.
Actually, I think you've just done a study on magnesium and cognitive health, haven't you?
Yeah. So we did a study on magnesium 3 and 8 for cognitive health, and it was actually 18 to 45-year-olds, and we looked at supplementation for a six-week period and looked at changes in cognitive function through different tests that we got them to do. We saw positive changes in episodic memory, and working memory, so really positive effects. For such a young cohort of people who still weren't having cognitive decline, we saw improvements there, and we saw improvements in sleep. We still haven't published that study yet, but it was very positive.
Can I ask what dose that was?
2,000 milligrams of magnesium 3 and 8.
Okay, so a hefty dose.
Because magnesium content of magnesium 3 is a lot less.
Yep.
Yeah, so I think it's 10% or something like that. Yeah. Brilliant. Now, have you got any herbs or what do you recommend?
Oh, I am just a little bit obsessed with the herb ginkgo biloba for this life stage. So the ginkgo tree can live for up to 1,000 years, and TCM prefers to use the seeds, but in Western herbalism we use the leaves. So when you take a look at this image, I want to take you right back to the doctrine of signatures, first discussed by the Greek physician Paracelsus over 600 years ago. When you're looking at the leaf structure, you can see the dual-lobed leaf, and that can represent the right and the left hemispheres of the brain. And then you've got those beautiful radiating branching veins within the leaf itself, and that can represent the microvascular structure within the brain. So ginkgo is perfectly placed to treat the menopausal brain. As the estrogen levels decline, we know that there is a reduced availability of glucose and oxygen within the brain, but combined with that is increased inflammation, which is almost like the perfect storm for a cognitive crisis. And this is what ginkgo can treat perfectly. I personally take 120 milligrams of the standardized extract every single day.
So how does it work?
Let's have a look. When we're looking at neurological functions, this herb has so much evidence behind it. It is an antioxidant, it scavenges free radicals, it counteracts that cognitive impairment, it improves memory, it enhances neuronal plasticity, which I found incredible. It protects against neuronal death. What I see clinically is that women will start saying to me, oh, I'm getting my words out. I had a CEO last week that came back in to see me, and she's like, I'm no longer petrified of board meetings. I can get the words out. My brain is functioning. Like, it really made a big difference for her. So this small, small herb can make a big difference.
How long did it take?
3 months for her.
3 months.
Okay. Yeah.
And so can you use it for different, in terms of ages and safety, is there any kind of, can kids take it?
I haven't actually dosed it with kids.
Okay.
It could be a good one, though, especially for neurological stuff.
And are you noticing with postmenopausal and that's where it's really
for me, this is where this herb absolutely shines because of the mechanism of actions and what's going on with the menopausal brain. It's just like a marriage kind of made in heaven. And when you're looking at the literature around dosing in this life stage, most of it sits at around 120 milligrams a day of that standardized extract. Some studies go up to 240, but in my opinion, why go higher when a 120 milligram dose shows increased cerebral blood flow, increase in working memory, increase in cognitive function? So always kind of with things like this, want to stick to the dose that the research says.
There's been some acute studies, I think, though. I think there's been some studies where they've used it acutely and looked at its effect on cognitive function. I think it was some quite positive stuff there when it can be used. But obviously, ultimately using it longer term is going to be far more beneficial.
Yeah, and that's why I sit on 120 milligrams every day, and I've been doing that for around 6 months, I'd say, now. And I think it's probably going to be one that I'm going to stay on lifelong.
Do you reckon that's okay to continue to stay on it ongoingly?
I haven't read anything that says not at that dose.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you go higher dose, there's going to be, you're going to run into problems, but that's where I'm always like, just use the lowest dose that the research says does the job.
I think that's, with a lot of our supplements that we're using, we've got doses, but a lot of those doses, they're just because they've been identified in research, right? So we don't know the optimal dose and we don't know how to potentially use it. And it's like, it could be that that's a good base dose, but during difficult times, during more stressful times, you could potentially increase that dose. We've done a lot of research on saffron, but I don't know whether more or less is better, or whether you should load initially for the first week. And so, but that's great. I love ginkgo.
Me too. Yeah.
Have you guys used it much?
But I think, even 200 milligrams of resveratrol actually helps enhance memory. And I think it, from what I read, it increases the communication between the hippocampus and other parts of the brain that are involved in memory too.
So thank you very much for that. That was brilliant. All of you.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
All right, before everybody leaves, we've got to do the testing. The 10 words. Are you ready? Okay, can you write down the 10 words? You got them?
You're just going good.
Yeah. Nick, you can remember them all? I can't even remember one.
Absolutely not.
Okay, all right. Here we go. Who got 10? Does anybody admit to a 9? Well, we got a 9. Wow.
Yes.
Well done. 8.
Good job.
7. Okay, I won't bring up the rest. No, there's no norm on this. I mean, ultimately, when you can do this in clinic, and ultimately you can do it and present certain words, and then show them after. But the time period makes a difference, obviously, and obviously the words and things like that. But it's a great tool to use to help people just remember certain things. So that's how it's one of the cognitive tests that we often do. So, okay, so we're finishing up now. So we certainly want to hear from you regarding how we went and give us some feedback on how we went and how this format. Obviously, this is the first time that we've done this, and you've had to hear a lot of my dad jokes, really bad jokes, which I find funny. So if you can complete the evaluation and just there's a QR code there. If you scan that, and you go up for 1 in 5 chance of winning $5,000 worth of $50 e-cards. Another dad joke. All right. So thank you very much for being here on a Saturday evening, and I enjoyed this. All thought was great, and I learned. I took away quite a few things for myself to be able to kind of utilise and be aware of over the next few weeks. So thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.